Okay, so now we go number two, overview of effective absence lessons. So what I'm going to do is just kind of walk you through chapter one of Aspire, the five different programs. Aspire is one. So just to give you some idea, right? So we've talked about the big picture. We've talked about the principles and some of the fundamental reasons and strategies and ideas behind what we do. So let's see how we put that into practice then. Up front, when I had you sign up for the thing, it says I get a free workbook. So if you want a free workbook and just sign up and give us your info, great. And then I have them up here. And let's do it the next break. You can come up and grab one of these. If you sign the thing to get a free workbook, you can come and take any one of the five different programs. If there's not enough of the one you want, I've got more at our booth 117, and stop by and get it there. All right, so let's jump in here a little bit and look at Aspire, for example. What do you notice about the name of this workbook, Aspire, just for an example? What does it say to you? Freedom, hopes, goals, dreams, encouragement, right? Yeah, all of that. Notice it's not called the Don't Have Sex Program, right? Is it a Don't Have Sex Program? Or is it a Have Sex When You're Married program, because it's beautiful and wonderful and special? Is there a difference between those two things? Yeah, so it's really then important that we understand what it is that we're trying to communicate. And so that's what we want to say. Now, we start off chapter one, living life on purpose. Why? Why is it important to talk to our students about purpose for life? Which kids are more likely to get into all sorts of risk behaviors? Kids who have a sense of purpose and this is where I'm going and this is what I'm doing, or kids who don't have any idea what they're doing, right? So we want to help them think about where it is that you're going with your life. And so we start off Aspire with, what are your hopes, goals, dreams? Now let me say a word about this. Our programs have PowerPoint. Navigator doesn't, but I'm working on for Navigator. But the other programs have PowerPoints. I don't use PowerPoint in the classroom. I developed these PowerPoints for my training seminars, but a lot of teachers wanted them, so I put them in the books, so the books do have the PowerPoints. The trick is, see, I usually do this on a chalkboard. I say, so, what do you kids want? And then I write it up on the chalkboard. So PowerPoint's a little bit more awkward that way. However, the things that you say are what's going to be up there. So when I say to a group of 9th graders, 10th graders, 8th graders, whatever group I'm talking to, and we'll talk about in-clinic presentation, but my main thing is classroom presentations. So if I'm talking in a counseling session or in a classroom situation, and I say, what are your hopes, goals, dreams for the future? What are some big picture things that you want to see in your life? What are you going to say? Career? College? Family? Marriage? Money? This is like Family Feud. What do we have on the board? Right? These are the things that kids say. Now, I've had opportunities to speak in the most difficult environments and the most privileged environments, let's just say. Very poor communities, very wealthy communities. And I find these same principles from all different groups. These are the kinds of things that kids do hope for. College, career, money, home, marriage, family, kids. So if I'm going to be talking to them about saving sex for marriage, why am I starting here then? Okay, have they possibly given some thought to this in the past? Have they probably ever really talked about it or written it down? Probably not. Maybe not. You know, whenever they talk about goal setting, what's the first thing they tell you to do? First step to accomplishing your goals is? So that's what we want to help them do. So the workbooks are part of that, right? So we want them to, and the whole purpose of the workbooks is, I started out doing this, just going into classrooms, talking, kids would be like, you know, I could tell they were energized by it. But then what I found is you go away, and it's kind of like, yeah, that was good, but what I find the workbooks do is it really sort of internalizes, it really adds to the stickiness, because now they're not just hearing me, but what? Now they're also reading it, they're writing it, they're saying it back. All of that significantly increases the effectiveness of the program. So here, for example, I want them to write down, everybody open up your book, page 8, page 7, write it down. What do you want for your hope for your future? I say this, if you can't get kids to have some sense of hope for the future, good luck getting them to appreciate the benefits of abstinence, right? Because why? What is the connection between hope for the future and the abstinence message? All of those things, right? So I have to give them, in other words, can they have sex right now? They can. What we're really talking about is the great exchange. What we're helping them understand is there's really something that you could exchange that for that's even better. If we don't make that case, why would they give it up? If they can do it now, why wouldn't they? Unless we're able to provide a reason, an alternative that's better than the alternative of having sex. And we want to make the case as clear as we can that there is something better than having it now. And that is understanding your future hopes, goals, and dreams. Okay. So the way I do it, and I'm not going to take time to do it now with, I call six people up to the front of the room, but I'll just do it here off of the workbook. I call this the life hike, and it's an illustration that I find really, really helpful for the kids. And I will call six kids to the front of the classroom and have them hold these cards, and these are in the teacher's manual. It comes with the six cards that they hold, and they have these different time periods. And I have the six kids up in the front of the class. And then I will say to them this, I don't know about you, but it's hard sometimes for me to think forward, to plan, to think ahead. I tend to be focused on the here and the now. I'm very much focused on, you know, the immediate. But I need to look up and out and think about long-term, big picture, where am I going out there? What is the future? And this illustration helps us understand why that's important. So I've got six kids up here in the front of the classroom, and I say, now I want you to look at these six different mountains, which represent six different time periods in your life. And I've taken your life and just laid it out this way so that we can sort of think through this and analyze this a little bit. Now, if you have, you look at these six mountains, where would you say the most significant events in your life are going to occur? Is it going to be out here? Is this the mountain where the most significant events in your life are going? You're just hoping to make it out here. What about here? Raise your hand when you get to the mountain that you think has the most significant events. So it looked like, I was staring into the bright light, but it looked like most of you said this one here. I think that's true. I think this one is important and has an impact on my future for sure. However, if you're talking about events, the question I ask is, where are the most significant life events going to occur? What are the life events that are going to happen here for most people? Graduate high school, graduate college, marriage, be family, career. Where are you going to live? Home? What city? Kids, right? There's a lot that happens here. And then I want them to think about how much will the things that happen here affect this part out here, a little bit or a lot? And when I, right? There's a lot that happens here. And then I want them to think about how much will the things that happen here affect this part out here, a little bit or a lot? And what I'm wanting you to understand is that this time period of your life has significant implications for the rest of your life, and most of your life will actually be lived out here, but it won't be decided out here. A lot of this is already determined. Now, the good news is, if you look at this, these are the things that you're hoping for. The good news is, where are you now? And you're at the front side of this very significant time period. The challenge is crossing the critical moment, moving from dependence to independence. And what I say is that this part here is what I call the critical moment. Here's the way I put it in the workbook. I say this. And I'm helping kids understand why this is such an important consideration. The valley between the first and the second mountain is steep, and the river running through it is difficult to cross. Some get caught in the current. Others slip in the rocks. Successfully crossing the valley of these transition years is critical in protecting your future. Does that make sense? So I'm wanting them to understand that this is sort of the critical moment in their life where we're crossing over from dependence on parents to independence from parents is a really important step for you. And what I'm wanting to do in this program is really help you understand that transition, because the problem is you're neither now. Are you here or are you here? The problem is you're kind of in transition right now, right? So, for example, if I'm talking to a group of high school students, I say, do your parents make all of your decisions for you, or do you make some? Oh, we make some. Do you make all your decisions, or do your parents make some? Well, my parents make some. See, so right now you're in this sort of transitionary period. But you're going from a time in your life when your parents made all your decisions to a time in your life when you will make all of your decisions. Neither of those is true right now. But you're going there. We want to help you think that through. That transition is really, really important to understand. Why? What are some of the negative pressures that weigh on me as a young person as I'm trying to cross that valley toward independence? What are some of the challenges that I'm going to face? Okay, drugs, alcohol, right? These are the kinds of things that are going to make it difficult to cross over. Drinking, drugs, sex, popularity, friends, boredom, self-image, media, right? These are the kinds of things that are constantly pressuring our kids. And so we want to talk about abstinence. Now, what do you notice about the way that we approach the subject of abstinence here in chapter 1? We're going to introduce the concept. What do you notice about the title of page 11 as we introduce the concept? Doesn't say don't have sex. What does it say? Benefits. Okay. Let's take those each at one at a time. Benefits. Are there benefits? See, sometimes people say to me, you know what you have to do is you have to make abstinence positive. Is that true? Do we have to make abstinence positive? Or is it positive already? Why do I make a distinction between I make it positive versus I understand that it is positive? See, if I feel like I have this burden of making it positive, what's my primary assumption? Is it not beneficial? It is beneficial. I gotta believe that. I have to absolutely believe that what I'm saying to these kids is the best thing for them. That's my point. It's not as though I've gotta be like, how am I gonna sell this rock? You know what I mean? It's like I've got this negative thing that I gotta somehow, you know, come up with some happy sauce to put on it. Do you see what I'm saying? I don't have to... What's that? Yes, it says... Exactly, exactly. And the reason I kind of think about this too is I was very early on in my start of all of this, I went to an HIV prevention seminar, which I was very young and naive. I was just getting started. I didn't know anything. I actually thought that an HIV prevention seminar was going to be on how to help prevent HIV. I got an eye opening. I couldn't stay. I couldn't sit through it. It was all about the joy of condoms. That would have been a better title for the seminar, The Joy of Condoms. And it was, I remember the guy saying, he goes, it's really important when we're trying to get kids to use condoms that we talk about all the flavors and the colors, and because otherwise they won't use them. And I'm just talking about a con job. I'm sitting there going, this is like a whole big hype thing, you know, that we've got to, come on, kids. And I couldn't take it. It was just weird. And, so anyway, I actually believe, I know, that this is beneficial. It's a beneficial, helpful message. I believe it. I want to communicate the benefit to them. I don't have to try to make it something it's not. It is beneficial. And then you mentioned the word considering. What's the point of this word? And why is that so important? Yeah, good. And so I'll even present it that way. I'll say, look, I'm not here to make this decision for you. What if I were to say to you, look, big decision, big decision. You've got a lot of big decisions to make. This is one of the biggest. I'm going to make this one for you. Could I do that? And I say just like that in the class, and they're like, no, you can't do that.
I know I can't do that. I can't make this decision for you, so I'm not going to try. It's not my decision to make, it's yours. So I'm not here to tell you what to do or how to live your life. This is your decision. I'm here to help you think through some things that I could think could be really, really helpful for you. How do you think they respond to that? Bring it! Look, if you're not going to jam this down on me like a little kid or something, then yeah, talk, bring it. Come on, what do you got? So it's so important. Again, it's how we communicate it is really, really important. I want to encourage them, and I want to treat them with respect and dignity, and I'm not trying to force this on you. I'm trying to help you think through something. And I will say to them, look, I believe that if I give you good information, you're going to be able to make a good decision. So I don't need to push you. I don't need to force you. In fact, going back to the point of the earlier presentation on the importance of marriage, when I go into a classroom, as I do, I speak at our local high school every semester. I'm there in the every semester in the spring and fall, I go there. And it's the one school I do regularly because I like staying connected. It's my own local high school where my kids went to school, and I just like staying involved there. It's where I started doing all this many, many years ago. So I was just there this past semester, and I'll be there again coming up. I walk into the classroom. And I say, they will usually introduce me as someone who's going to talk to us about abstinence or something. But the first thing I will say is, in other words, I don't beat around the bush. I don't try to mamby-pamby, you know, hey, I'm going to talk to you about relationships. Yes, I'm going to talk to you about relationships. There's something far more at the core of what I'm here to talk to you about. And I'll say, hey, my name's Scott, and I'm here to talk about abstinence, which is saving all sexual activity for marriage. And as soon as I say that, you might be like, what? We never hear anything about that. I get it. That's why I'm here. I'm going to say some things in the next few days that you're not going to hear anywhere else. So listen up. Does that make sense? And then they're like, wow, cool. So in other words, I don't hide around. I don't hide from it. I just treat it the way it should be treated. And that is, I'm going to say stuff to you you're not going to hear about in the media. Your teacher's going to talk to you about it, and the teacher's sitting right there. I said, your teacher's going to talk to you about all different things, about birth control, about disease, about all this stuff, but I want to focus, really focus in the few days that I have with you, I want to focus in really clearly on what are the benefits of saving all sexual activity for marriage. You're not going to hear this anywhere else. So let's go. Are you ready? Oh, yeah, I'm ready. And so that's the way that I present, and it works very, very well. They're just like, yeah. And so I just want to be very upfront with them. I want to be clear. I want you to consider some stuff. You do whatever you want, but at the end of the day, I think there's real benefit to you for waiting. So our definition then is abstinence is choosing to save all sexual activity for marriage. And notice I don't say until. I'm okay with until. Abstinence until marriage, saving sex until marriage is fine. I think this is a little bit more precise. I like this. Formation here. Abstinence is choosing to save all sexual activity for marriage. It allows me to make, I think, a broader point, a bigger point. That this isn't just about waiting until marriage, but what? Even after marriage, I need to be abstinent too in that sense. In other words, I say it this way. I'm not telling you to do anything that doesn't also apply to me. The message that I'm teaching you is a universal principle. Before you're married, and after you're married. So, for example, if a businessman is married and he's away from his wife on a trip, should he have sex with anybody he meets along the way? Or should he save all sexual activity for his marriage? Do you see? So it's not that, you know, this abstinence message is for kids. What I'm sharing with you is a universal principle that applies to everybody. It applies to me, it applies to you, it applies... That abstinence is waiting, is saving all sexual activity for a marriage relationship. Notice, for example, also, if a businessman is married, think about the consistency. I guess what I'm wanting to say to you is think about the consistency of the message. Everything that we're teaching kids is going to benefit them before marriage and when? And after marriage. And after marriage. Think about the comprehensive sex ed message, which is, you know, keep contraception in the glove box or in your bag or in your wallet or whatever, because you just never know. When a businessman is married and goes away from, you know, on a trip for a week, his wife doesn't say, honey, remember to take the condoms. Be safe. Be safe. Does his wife say that? No.
In other words, it's an inconsistent message. What we're teaching kids is consistent with what they're going to need. Anyway, that's why I use for rather than until. I'm okay with until, but I think it's a little more precise. I can say more with it. Yes? Yeah. 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 Right. Right. Absolutely right. Yeah. I think it's a superior way to communicate it. Right? The other's okay, but I think this is better. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I know that a lot of us in here have mentioned being SRA certified.
Yes. Yeah.
What's your perspective on that? Do you think the word abstinence carries a negative connotation?
Well, yeah. What I believe is that, you know, we're called the Absence of Marriage Education Partnership. And what I believe is we need to clearly communicate what that is. Okay. Yeah. So I'm not a fan of changing the language myself. So I think that... And the biggest thing for me, it's not so much about the word. It's about clarity. I want to be so, as you'll see, I think I've got it coming up in a different presentation. Absence until marriage or saving sex for marriage, I think those are good formulations. I really like, I tend to use most saving sex for marriage. Hey, kids, I'm here to talk about absence, which is saving all sexual activity for marriage. I just explain what it means, that's all. All right, so choosing to save all sexual activity for marriage, and then what does that mean? Then we've got to have a little bit more filling that out. Sexual activity includes any type of genital contact or sexual stimulation. Absence is the only sure way to protect your body, mind, and heart from the various consequences of premarital sexual activity. Absence is the safest, healthiest lifestyle and one of the best ways to prepare for a healthy future marriage. So there you can see the A and the M too, here. Absence is the safest, healthiest lifestyle and, ampersand, one of the best ways to prepare for a healthy future marriage. So you can see, even in our definition, we're communicating the A and the M here very clearly. Now, why is it really necessary and important for me to have a clear definition of what I mean by abstinence at the outset? Chapter 1, we're going to define what we mean by absence, because why? Okay, so if I don't define it, what might they mean? What might they think I mean? If I just talk about absence without defining it, what might they think I mean? They might think sex is bad. They might think what? Oral sex is okay. Okay, yeah, never have sex. They might be all over the map, and we might expect them to be. So let's teach them, right? Now, if I don't have a definition of what I mean... And notice I don't have specific sexual acts, right? So I'm not going to say it's don't do this, 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 and this, because why? It's all. And how many things are there? How many things can you list? I mean, seriously. See, if I only list a few things and say it's not this, 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 or this, then what? That's not on the list. So that gets a little bit tricky. The other thing about listing specific things is when kids say, what's that? Ah! So I try to be a little more careful in that way. And I've been doing this a long time. I find this works really, really well to do it this way. But the next slide, I think, is going to get to this point. If I don't define what I mean, it's really tricky because the messages out there are really quite varied. I found this on a Google search from the University of Alberta Health Center. This was the top list of the search rankings at the time that I did it. You know, it's dynamic and it changes all the time. But at the time that I did this search, I came up with this from the University of Alberta Health Center. It says, abstinence doesn't have to mean shutting off your sexuality. In fact, with a little imagination, abstinence can be a very sexy, satisfying choice if that's what you want it to be. It might include holding hands, flirting, feeding each other, gazing in your partner's eyes, massage, sharing fantasies, bathing together, necking, self-pleasuring, touching your partner's body, oral sex, strolling arm in arm. There are a million possibilities. So maybe we should use that as a definition. Why wouldn't you use that as a definition?
That's like
this doesn't cross the guardrail?
I'm going to get to objective and subjective and why that's so important. Is this objective or subjective? Where do you see subjectivity here? It doesn't have to mean, with a little imagination, it can be, and here it is, it's what you want, whatever you want it to be. This says absence is whatever you want it to be. It might include, here's a little starter kit, because there are a million possibilities, right? And why only a million? Do you like the way they do this too? Oral sex, strolling arm in arm. I like this one. We're always trying to come up with good activities. Our workbooks we've got in the teacher's manual, we've got all these different activities. How about this one? Bathing together. There's a nice absence activity. What are you doing in there, Cindy? Oh, Jack and I are just having a bath together. We had an abstinence class today, Mom. I mean, we joke around about it, but this is really bizarro world. It's really bizarro world. And people are serious about this. That you should encourage kids to sort of explore their sexuality. Now look, when I'm talking about, if I'm on a talk show or radio program or something, and I'm going to address sex education, comprehensive sex education, I try to present their view as accurately as I possibly can so that if they were in the room, they'd say, yes, that's what we believe. Does that make sense? I don't want to distort in any way what they believe. So I'm going to do my best at all times to accurately and faithfully communicate what it is I believe. Here's what I believe that they would say that they believe. We believe that sex is good, but there are negative consequences that can happen, such as pregnancy, and disease, so we want them to use protection so that they can have sex without the consequences. Does that make sense? That's what I think they would say that they are trying to communicate. So they would say all these are good things because someone said you can't get pregnant, right? So yeah, you can't get pregnant. You can do all these other things. You can experience, you know, the parts of sex, and they would say that these are good and valuable things for kids to experience. The problem is that it's totally subjective. There are a million possibilities. This is someone basically sitting down at a word processor and just making stuff up, right? They're just making stuff up. And they could apparently go on for quite some time, but they decided to stop, right? And then you get the idea. So for an abstinence definition, we want to have an objective definition with three key components. Number one, it's choosing. We say abstinence is a choice. It's not your girlfriend's choice, not your boyfriend's choice, not your teacher's choice, not your parents' choice. You should respect your parents. You should listen to your teacher. But at the end of the day, you're going to be the one who has to make this choice. What are you going to choose to do? Number two, it's saving all sexual activity, not going right up to the line. And one of the activities that we have in the Aspire workbook at this point, too, is we've got, I put a piece of tape here, and then I come down here, and I put another piece of tape, and then I go 1 foot more, I put another piece of tape. So a starting line, a finish line, and then a foot past the finish line, I've got another piece of tape. Call a couple kids up at the front of the class, and I say, I want you to run as fast as you can. I'm going to time you right now. I want you to run as fast as you can to get to the tape, the first tape, stop and don't cross the second tape, right? And what happens? And they will cross over the second tape. And then I say, why'd you do that? I told you to stop. Why didn't you do it? And the answer is, I couldn't stop because I had momentum. And the same, of course, is true physiologically, right? That to sort of encourage kids to just go right up to the line. You're talking about the guardrails. Just go right up. You won't go over, right? I was reading a book by a guy who was trying to write a book about abstinence, and he had been very sexually promiscuous, and he was talking about his days of promiscuity. And he said, you know what I always used to tell the girls? I always used to tell the girls what? Hey, baby, we won't go all the way. What was his goal? to go all the way. What did he know? If I could just get her started, right, I'd have a lot better chance of getting across the finish line, as it were. And so we're talking about all sexual activity. Now, what if you have kids say, as I have had them say, no, 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 my girlfriend and I literally had a guy with his girlfriend come to me at the end of a class and say, no, 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 we've done all that other stuff. We've never gone over the line, sexual intercourse. Then is it okay? Then is it okay? Or are there still consequences, right? Can they still get an STD? Can there still be emotional bonding? I still remember a little girl at an assembly I did out in Dillon or Butte, Montana, one of the two. I forget which one it was. But I remember I was at a Catholic school, and this sweet little eighth grade girl came down to me afterward with tears in her eyes. Eighth grade, 13 years old. I still remember, years ago, I still remember this. This sweet little girl came down to me, and she says, just with tears in her eyes, she said, remember the part where you were talking about bonding and the whole intimate? She said, I didn't know. And then she said this, it was just oral sex, but afterwards he was like, screw you. And she was emotionally devastated by that, as we understand she would be, right? Was that okay? Or did she suffer from that? See. So these things aren't okay. Objectively, they're not okay. That they do harm. So it's choosing to save all sexual activity. Now, if you pick up magazine, a teen magazine, Teen People, YM, 17, Cosmo Girl, whatever those teen magazines are, they will have articles from time to time, I've seen them, on abstinence. Is it abstinence until marriage? No, you won't find that. If you find that, please send it to me. You won't find that. It'll be abstinence until when? Till you're ready. Till you're in love. Till you're mature. Till you're with the right one. Till you take our 20-point Cosmo Girl quiz. This is the thing. So this is, what is missing is this, right? And so it's such an important consideration because, you know, look, I've had so many different examples of this. I was at are you familiar with The Art of Loving Well? It's an anthology of character stories. Some of them are about sexual activity. But this is from the introduction, Boston University of Boston Press. This is from the beginning, the preface to the book. It says, a third theme of this book is that sexual relationships are a big deal and should never be taken lightly. Momentary satisfaction outside the context of? Momentary satisfaction outside the context of a mature and deeply intimate relationship usually results in someone getting hurt. Now, what is a mature and deeply intimate relationship? Can you define it for me? Nice. Can high school students have a mature and deeply intimate relationship? Can high school students think that they have a mature and deeply intimate relationship? If I say to high school students, don't have sex unless you're in a mature and deeply intimate relationship, what might they say? Check mark. Right? Right? That was my abstinence lesson. My abstinence lesson was a green light to have sex. How'd that work out? In addition, the pressure that it is somehow cool to be sexually experienced at an early age can overcome better judgment. What's an early age for sex? Do you see the problem here? Then listen to this one. And this one, I'll have to read it twice because it makes your head spin a little bit. However, unless they are in the context of a deeply intimate and committed partnership, sexual encounters usually complicate problems rather than solve them. See what I mean? Let me reread it. However, unless they are in the context of a deeply intimate and committed partnership, sexual encounters usually complicate problems rather than solve them. What does that say? What is a deeply intimate and committed partnership? And how is being in one of those going to make sex solve my problems? It's really messed up. Now, what word is missing in all of this? And my point is, when you take out the word marriage, what you end up is with gobbledygook. It really is. It doesn't make any sense. You can't define this. When you take out the word marriage, you cannot define it. What is it?
It's all subjective.
It's totally subjective. It's very problematic. And we've got abstinence programs that don't talk about marriage. How does that work? That's what's so important, I think.
Yeah. Say, until marriage, now we can say we're talking about all of you, but
you
still
Well, I think it kind of goes back to the point that I said earlier about I'm not here to tell you what to do. What I'm going to communicate to you is what is the safest, healthiest, best choice. And whatever you want to do is completely up to you. I'm not going to quibble about all the different possible configurations. I just can't do it. Now, the marriage issue is actually kind of flipped on them, actually, because they've sort of lost their weapon, right? Because they used to say, you say wait until marriage, but we can't get married, so you're... Well, that's sort of gone now, you know? So I don't really spend a lot of time worrying about that. In fact, I did have one teacher call me and say, my principal wants to know, you know, do you address same-sex marriage in your workbooks? And I said, no, because we don't want to discriminate. Right? Look, to single out same-sex marriage is to discriminate between types of marriage. Now, the rallying cry for that group was marriage equality. You can't have it both ways. You can't want to be the same and yet also be discriminated out as separate. Do you see what I'm talking about? So I don't talk about different types of marriage. I also had one student say to me in a class, when you say marriage, do you mean a man and a woman? Or do you mean like two men or two women? And I said, well, I'm glad that you brought that up. I am talking about a man and a woman, and here's why. Everything we teach is rooted in research. I'm not making stuff up. Everything I'm teaching is based in fact. Same-sex marriage is a brand new thing that we don't yet have enough data for me to tell you anything factual about. So I'm sticking with what I know, which is one man, one woman. I've got a lot of data and research. When I say marriage, that's what I'm talking about. Okay? What's that? That's true. It's true. Now, I'm actually, in that response, being charitable. Because the data is not in favor of same-sex relationships at all. And you should look at the work of Mark Regeneris down at the UT in Texas, in Austin. And his website, I believe, is familystructurestudies.com, I think it is. Something like that. Google it, you'll find it. It's familystructurestudies.com or .org, one of those. But he's done marvelous work to lay out all of the different possible configurations, living arrangements, and what it shows is one man, one woman married is best for children. He takes all the different possible configurations. Mark Regeneris, University of Texas. In fact, his research was rather controversial because the advocates for same-sex marriage did not like his research, showing that it was sort of at the bottom, whereas married couples, one man and one woman, was at the top. They actually tried to get him fired, and the Board of Regents at UT had to look into it, and then they said, no, his research is sound. You know, we're not going to censure him for this. And so he had to have quite a battle just to get his research out there. So when I say there's not enough research, I'm being charitable. I could drag out what's out there, but I'm willing to say, you know, let's give it some time. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the marriage issue, as I spent the morning discussing, really is fundamental. And so many illustrations would make this clear to you. I was in Washington, D.C. years ago. I was actually doing a training for our game plan program. And the head of, we were in 16 schools in Washington, D.C., and the head of the HIV AIDS department from the health department of Washington, D.C. was there at the workshop.
And similar to what we're just talking about, she came in, and as I got to this part, she said, you can't say that. You can't say marriage here. She says, we've got homosexual students, and they can't get, this is when they couldn't get married. They can't get married. You can't say marriage here. And she said, you have to change this definition. I said, I can't change the definition. I'm not making this up. This is objective, factual information. This is what abstinence is. She said, if you don't change this definition, you can't teach us in our schools. I said, well, then I guess we're not going to teach us in your schools. Awkward. It was really awkward. I didn't know what was I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? So she sat there, I sat there, we all sat there. Weird. I said, look, I'm not saying you can't have other programs in your schools that teach other things. You can, but this is an abstinence program. All I'm saying is if you want to teach abstinence, this is what abstinence is. Well, now she's kind of on the hook, because what are we going to do? So she says, well, you're saying this definition is just for this program? I said, yeah, just so, oh, well then, okay. What was she going to do? Right? So, but these are the kinds of things that happen. I had a guy at a training in Milwaukee years ago. He said, I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable saying marriage. I would rather say long-term mutual monogamous committed relationship. You've heard that. You've heard that language, right?
Yeah, that's what
we said before marriage. I said, well, sounds great. Got any data to back that up? I said, I don't have the luxury of making up stuff to say that makes me feel good. I can only say what I know, and I've got data to back up what I'm saying about marriage. What data do you have? Bring it. I had the same thing with a school in our area that emailed me and said, if you would change the part in your book that says marriage to committed relationships, we'd like to use your curriculum, but we can't use it as it is. What did I say to them? They wanted me to change the word marriage to committed relationship. I didn't say no. What did I say? I said, everything that we teach is rooted in research. I said, please send me the data to support the change that you would like us to make. We'd be happy to consider it. Right? Isn't that the right answer? It's not me deciding what to say. I'm constrained to say what is true. And so if you have something that's true that I need to get a look at because I'm unaware and send it my way, I'll be happy to look at it. So all of these things are very, very, so many illustrations like this. One last illustration, I was in this was north of Washington, D.C. some years back, just a few years ago, actually. I'm set up kind of like this. I've got 65 teachers from schools all over the county, and I'm starting to do my presentation, and I'm starting off with why marriage matters. It's the first thing I do. Wherever I go, boom, we're starting here, why marriage matters in an abstinence program. And the lady that was introducing me looked at my PowerPoint opening slide, and as she comes up to introduce me, she says to me, kind of whispers in my ears, we're both standing in front of the group, she says, you can't say marriage. I said, what? You can't say marriage. We don't allow people to say the word marriage here. You can't say that. What? So I said, well, come on, let's go out in the hallway. Come on. So I called over the lady who had invited me to come out and do the training seminar for our programs for all these 50-some-odd schools. And we're out in the hallway, and I said to her, you know, Sally here says, I can't talk about marriage, but my whole program is about marriage. If I can't say marriage, I don't have anything to say to you. I don't know why you brought me out here. Huh. Awkward again, you know. We're just standing there in the hallway. I got a room full of people. They're waiting. I was being introduced. Now we're out in the hallway. So, you know, the three of us are sort of standing there looking at each other like, huh, what are we going to do? I don't know. Weird. So, finally I said, look, I'm here. I'm all set up. The people are here. Why don't I just go ahead with the presentation, and then when I'm done, You can change it, tweak it, modify it, do whatever you want. Okay, that sounds good. So back in we went. Now, do I want them to change it, tweak it, modify it? Can you change, tweak, modify truth? In other words, good luck with that. Give me a day to communicate truth, and then yes, you do whatever you want. Okay? So we go back in, and now she introduces me sort of with a warning label. She goes, now our speaker for today, Mr. Phelps, he's going to be using, you can see her kind of choking up, he's going to be using the word marriage. Now, you know, we don't use that word here. So while he's talking, just be thinking of other words that you could use instead. Now, I used to say years ago, I used to say it's still legal in America to talk about marriage. So while it's still legal, let's keep saying it. That's not funny anymore. There are increasing numbers of places where they were like, no, you don't say that. Don't stop it. Don't say that. So anyway, so she introduces me with that warning label, and we got started. And it was a rough go. I'm going to say that wasn't my best start. It was kind of a rough go with some of these teachers in public schools throughout this county. But as we got going, I could sense they were kind of getting into it. Now, when it starts off that way, am I going to be more hesitant and reserved, or am I sort of pedal to the metal? Oh, it's on now. It's on. So we're going. We are going. And so we're going. And by the end of the day, this lady comes up to me, and the three of us reconvened. And the lady says to the other lady, the host, she goes, this was good. Why didn't we have 2 days of this training? Because one day isn't enough. That's what she said. And she said, there's some schools that this program isn't in, and we've got to get it in. That was the lady who started the day saying, you can't talk about marriage. Ended the day saying, we've got to make sure this is in every school in our county. Isn't that incredible? Now, I just use that to say it's a testimony to the power of truth. And I say these stories to encourage you. You will face opposition. Don't back down. Don't back down. Washington State is one of our most difficult areas. I was at a training there a few years ago. And they said to me, Scott, the health department says we can't talk about marriage. They won't let us. They won't let us say absence until marriage. We have to say committed to relationship. They won't let us say it. What should we do? I said, you know what I think you should do? I think you should tell the health department to shut up. And you should do it. Just do it. What are you going to do? Go to jail? Do it! And I'm serious about this. I'm serious about it. Why are we being intimidated to not speak the truth? So I encourage people. I encourage you. Stand up. Speak out. Be clear about it. Don't back off. The objective definition of absence is choosing to save all sexual activity for marriage. I want to encourage them in that way. Now, absence is the safest, healthiest lifestyle. Is this a fact or opinion? Is it objective or subjective? Is it factual? Is it objective? If by absence I mean don't have sex until you're ready. Right? Is it objective if by absence I mean don't have sexual intercourse but everything else is okay? In other words, it's only factually, objectively true when it means saving all sexual activity for marriage. Then and only then can we say this is the safest, healthiest lifestyle. It's an objective definition of abstinence. So important. Is it possible for someone who's been sexually active to still choose abstinence? And then we've got true stories throughout the workbooks. And this one is Ty Gooch is a friend of mine who played for the Northwestern Wildcats. The year they went to the Rose Bowl against USC some years back. And he was waiting. And he said, I felt like an oddball because all my teammates, all my friends, kind of like AC Green and Game Plan, all my teammates were doing it and they were wanting me to do it. And I just, now I'm married to Renee. We've got two beautiful little girls. We're thankful we were able to make it through that critical moment. And affirmation at the end of every chapter, I will live my life with a sense of purpose. Now,
We've got stories throughout the books. Some waited, some didn't wait. And they're just true stories. We try to help kids examine and understand. When the researchers that evaluate our programs go back and maybe they'll do a six-month follow-up, what do the kids remember most? Stories. I remember the one about the football player. I remember about the guy with the motorcycle. I remember about the one. And so we find that the stories really help take these truths and make them more clear for the kids. All right, very good. So that is it 2:35? All right, that's time for another 3:25. Oh, I'm on Chicago time. Bad. Get my watch out. Yes, that's right. All right. Well, let's take another little break here. Let's go another 15-minute break, and then we'll be back. Okay? Okay. Let's jump in. I want to do just one more little example from Quest. I did some examples of Aspire, a couple of examples from Quest. Difference about Quest is that it... all of my workbooks have true stories in them, as I've mentioned. And Quest is a little bit different because what I did for... Whereas the other books have stories sort of sprinkled out, usually there are two or three small vignettes throughout the chapter, Quest has one story per chapter, and it's larger. So it will begin, every chapter in Quest will begin and end with a story, kind of a beginning and an ending, and then the middle has the content which the story illustrates. I think it works very well. And this one, I wanted to show you chapter 5. Staying on track, a couple of things I just wanted to point out here. So the way this one works in using the PowerPoint is, so Debbie's decision is the story for this chapter. So the chapter starts off with Debbie's decision. So you read the story together with it on kind of the blank screen, and then the questions pop up that relate to the story, and then you go into the content. Sexual activity typically involves the reproductive system. Why do you suppose it's called that? So should sexually active teens be surprised if they become or get someone pregnant? Because, see, what sexual activity is it's really it's engaging the reproductive system in which people reproduce themselves, so it shouldn't come as a shock. And then here's a picture of a sexually active teen. What story does this picture tell? Not sort of the image that we always get. Now, we're headquartered in Chicago, and so Illinois passed a law specifically trying to knock us out of schools. They told us that, the people who were supporting it. And so they added a component where you have to teach contraception. Are we going to do that? Are we going to teach contraception? Yes, we are. We're not going to teach them how to use it. We're not going to teach them where to get it. We're not going to encourage it in any way. But we can happily explain what it is. And here's the way we do it. When sex results in the fertilization of the egg, this is called conception. The word means to begin. The attempt to block conception is called contraception. The prefix contra means against. In this case, means to work against conception. So conception is the beginning of the process of the growth and development of a baby. Contraception is the attempt to block the beginning of the process of the growth and development of a baby. What is the best way to ensure that pregnancy before marriage will not occur? Saving all sexual activity for marriage, or using products designed to attempt to prevent conception from occurring as a result of having sex. So... the point here is that we're just trying to be as clear as possible. We're teaching contraception. This is what it is. And we're being as clear as we possibly can. And we're explaining the differences between the two. And so when I do this on the chalkboard with the kids, I say, which is the best way to be sure? And they say A. Then I say, is that objective or subjective? Because I've already explained all that to them, right? And it's objective. I say, absolutely. And I'm here. Look, whatever you choose to do is up to you. My purpose in being here today is that you understand the difference that it's objectively, factually true that abstinence is the best way to ensure, the only way to ensure, that pregnancy won't occur before marriage, if that's your goal. Okay. So, which of the following will be more challenging in caring for a baby? There's the part I wanted to get to. So here's the graph we had earlier. This is actually in our Quest book, the graph that I showed earlier this morning. And I'm going to teach this. This is an eighth grade curriculum. I'm going to teach the kids what's happening here, why this is important, why does this matter, what are the challenges of caring for a child, what does a child, as a single parent, what does a child need? What are some things a child needs? What is it?
Diapers.
Very practical. What else? Food. Clothes. Love, care, touch, time, right? All of these things. Now, perhaps one of the most difficult things in talking about marriage and a mom and a dad is what? What is particularly difficult about teaching this in today's culture? Many kids don't have a mom and a dad, right? Now, this particular program, I piloted it in an all-black school. I was in Chicago on the south side. I'm the only white guy in the building. And I'm teaching them the importance of marriage and family and that kids should have a mom and a dad. Is that difficult to do? What are the statistics? 72% of black children today are born outside of marriage relationships. So what do I know going in? Most of them don't have a dad in them. I know that. So, what do I do? Not teach it? Unfortunately, that's not an option available to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, you want to teach it. You want them to be a cycle breaker.
Exactly. So, first of all, it's not as though I get to pick and choose what to teach. Secondly, even though it may be challenging, I want to, need to. Now, I'm bringing this up because I sense that, and what I get from teachers oftentimes is that they are unwilling to address this because of the fact that many of their kids don't have an intact married home. Therefore, we can't teach it. And they're saying it, I understand they're saying it out of sensitivity. My point is that your sensitivity isn't helping your kids, it's harming your kids. Does that make sense? Exactly. So what I try to help teachers understand is that sensitivity doesn't help them, it hurts them. And you have to sort of get over your own sensitivity and teach this to them because it's helpful for them. So I teach this in this school, and the response is fantastic. It's fantastic. They want to, need to, learn about this and hear this. And so I'm teaching this to them. So, according to researchers, marriage is the safest, healthiest place for the rearing of children. Why do you suppose this is? And then here is an activity. I want you to take out a separate sheet of paper, just write on here somewhere in your, just write on a piece of paper. Do this activity. Let's see how we do. I actually have an ad. I haven't looked through the program, but I'm supposed to have an ad that has this in it in the program. If maybe you saw it. I didn't look yet. But I said in the ad that if you do this and you get it right, you get a prize. So we'll do that here today. If you get this right, you get a prize. So this is the type of family structure, and then this is the percentage of children in poverty. And so this was an article in the Wall Street Journal quoting U.S. Census Bureau data. What is the percentage of children living in poverty for those growing up with a single, those born to a single mom, those with living together parents, and those with married parents, choose from these four options. Renata, you're ineligible for this. But go ahead, see how you do. Take a minute to do that. Okay, pencils down. I just always wanted to say that. All right, now, we have online training available for our Game Plan and Navigator programs that was kind of done up pretty well by a group that it cost a lot to do it. I don't have it for the other programs. Anyway, we charge, without the teacher manual, we charge $125 for that online training. If you get this right, I will give you a free online training. Okay? So
that's why I said pencils down. Let's begin. Type of family structure, percentage of children living in poverty who have a single parent. Answer is 40%. Who has 40%? Anybody have something different?
35.
Anybody else have 30? What do you have? 22 and 35? Answer is 35. Number two, living together. Percentage of children living in poverty? Answer is 22. Anybody else have 22? Somebody have something different? 40. Anybody else have something different? Answer is 40. She's excited. It's like, we have someone in the running. Anybody else in the running besides, what's your name?
Melinda
is in the running. And? What's your name?
Nicole.
Wonderful. Okay, here we go. I'm getting goosebumps. Like, wait, did I already say what I'm giving away? All right. Percentage of children living with married parents is? Who's got 8%? Somebody has something different. Somebody has something different? Answer is? Ding, 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 ding. So we have two winners. Wonderful. Congratulations. Very good. I just did a seminar in last month. I was in Dallas at the Texas Teacher Convention. I did this in three different workshops. No one got it right in all three workshops. Look, it's very the reason why I say I'll give you $125 training is because it's very difficult. This is the first time two people got it right. That's very good. The point is, it's very difficult because it's not what we think. It's not what we expect. And so congratulations to both of you. So here is the... Well, you tell me, why didn't we get this right? What did we expect? You'd think, first of all, you're assuming that this is two incomes. And that's probably the first, right? We didn't think that maybe that's not two incomes. Maybe that's more strain on one income, right? So, but the reason I really like this is, what do I want to teach the kids? Now, they're growing up in a culture in which do they see marriage and living together as similar or distinct? Does this explain it or demonstrate that it's similar or distinct? Distinct. And that's the point that I need to make to them, right? So I'm able to demonstrate. Now look, this is one metric. There's lots of these. And Glenn's book, The Ring Makes All the Difference, is all about this. And same with Why Marriage Matters. A lot of good information like this. What's different? Well, let me start. Let me show you. There's so much that's different. So what this is able to help illustrate is, in fact, Maggie Gallagher and Maggie and Glenn and I and a few others, we went around the country a few years ago. We did like 9 different cities. We did a full-day seminar called Restoring the Dream, Why Married. We did all day on this, right? And Maggie Gallagher used to point out, as we would do these workshops together, she would point out that the data for cohabiting couples and single couples is far more similar than these two. In other words, we tend to think these two are similar. The reality is that these two are similar. And in this case, the single actually does better than the living together. So, look, again, I'm able to say to kids, I'm not telling you what to do. But I just think you should know some of this stuff. I think it's really important for you to this is U.S. Census Bureau data. I think it's helpful for you to understand that all the things that you're sort of seeing and hearing out in culture may not necessarily be what's best for you or for your children. And I find that teens are already thinking about their children. And so it's helpful sometimes to help them start thinking about what is it going to be like for my children. All right, and then we come back to Debbie at the end. And so she waited. All right. But that's just one illustration from the Quest program, and now I want to get on to the next session. Okay, so effective teaching techniques. So let's go ahead. We've done Why Marriage Matters. We've given you some samples from the absence lessons on how we apply that, and you can see how thoroughly marriage then saturates everything I'm communicating to them, right? And that really is the point that I'm trying to make here, is that is not a part of the message, it's the heart of the message. And now effective teaching techniques.
The way I like to look at this, I wrote an article many years ago as a young pastor entitled Message versus Method. And it was because so many churches, I felt like, at least in our area, were kind of watering down the message in order to try to attract people. And I was saying, no. The message never changes. Methods must always change. That's totally fine to change the methods, but we don't change the message. So I want us to look at understanding the difference between message and method and why that's so important to distinguish between those two things, that we remain dedicated and committed to the message while we may, in fact, use many methods. One message, many methods. So here it is, abstinence until marriage would be sort of the main message there. And you can use drama and dance, you can use curricula, peer educators, media, all different methods. You could also call it saving sex for marriage. That's fine. As I said, I usually say abstinence, which is saving all sexual activity for marriage. But the key component here is the message is central. That's the thing that is unchanging. We can change all these here and have all different class speakers, events, web-based programs, after-school clubs, lots of different ways to communicate. Drama, dance, video, great, fine, use it all. But the message never changes. The message is central. The message was true 100 years ago. It will be true 100 years from now. And so this is the thing that we want to make sure that we keep central. Methods are peripheral. So I say the message is central and the methods are peripheral. That's important because if you are muddled on your message, the methods don't matter. Does that make sense? If you're not really rock solid clear on what your message is, then the methods don't really matter. It's not going to work. And so important to keep those two things together. All right. Now I want to talk about the methodology. What is the methodology that we employ that works so well in communicating this? As Sunel was saying earlier, you've been using the programs for how long? 9th year. And you've seen really good results. I mean, I didn't even know that. As I told you, I want to get more information about it. That's fantastic. And later on, I'm going to mention some of the work that Renata's been doing down in Collier County with fantastic results. I think the programs work well for the reasons that I'm sharing with you. We've got a good, solid message that we don't compromise ever. The reason I told you those stories about teachers and authorities saying, no, you can't say this, you can't say that. The reason I'm saying that is because I want you to think, what are you going to do when they say, we're happy to have you in our school, just don't say anything about marriage, please. We don't want to deal with that. What are you going to do? My concern is too many people say, okay, just let us in. As long as we can get in, we'll say whatever you want us to say. Well, what's the point? So I'm trying to inspire you and encourage you that if someone says to you, you can speak but don't say marriage, that you would just walk away. Just, never mind, it's not even worth it. It's not worth my time. It's not going to be helpful for the kids. So this is and these are just illustrations from my own experience for whatever encouragement that is to you. All right. So I find this quadrant to be really helpful in communicating to you the way I teach and the way all of my materials were laid out. So inductive is to ask questions, right? Inductive and then deductive. Inductive is to ask questions versus deductive, which is making statements, right? So these two things are opposite. I'm asking questions, I'm making statements. Objective is based on facts. Subjective is based on opinions. So I really need to understand the difference between these two things. Now let me take a few minutes to do the difference between objective and subjective. And I like to do this. I do this again in the classroom because I want kids to know it. Because I know sometimes if a school has me come in, who's coming in after me or before me? Planned Parenthood, yeah. So I want to make sure that I give my kids some equipment by which to analyze whoever the presenter is. So I'll usually use a chair. And I'll put it up here so we can all see it. And I will say, I don't know if it'll fit. So I will talk about an objective description of this chair. The chair is the object. Man sees chair, subject, verb, object. This is the object. So an objective description is to describe the chair. And this chair, how would I describe this objectively? How many legs does it have? And it is padded. Is this leather or is it fabric? It's fabric. Is this red or is it black? It's black. So objectively, I would say this chair is made out of metal. It has four legs. It has padding that is fabric. It's not leather. And that would be an objective description of the chair. What if I were to say to you, this chair is made out of red oak and it has six legs and it has black leather on it? What would you say to me? No. You are wrong. You are not right. You are wrong. How would we know that I'm wrong? Because it's verifiable. It's factually verifiable. We can factually... Now, what if we wanted to have a debate about it? What if I said, you know, come on to the front of the class, we're going to have a debate about whether or not this chair is made out of metal or red oak? How long could that debate last? We couldn't have a debate. Why? Because facts are inarguable things. We can't argue about the fact. The fact is it is metal. The fact is it is not oak. There can be no debate about that. Objective things are factual and non-debatable. Does that make sense? Now, subjective, I'm the subject here. I may have some views or opinions about the chair that I might want to share. I might say, I wish that chair were made out of red oak and I wish it had a black leather seat. I think that'd be a much better chair. And if it were made out of red oak, I would have that chair. I love red oak with black leather. I think it's fantastic. That's what I think the chair should be. Now, could we debate over that, over what the chair should be made out of? What would be the best material for making a chair? How long could that go on for? Quite some time, because that's subjective. Okay. So it's really important to understand what we're doing and whether or not what we're doing is subjective or objective. And I use that illustration with the kids and say, look, I'm not here to tell you my subjective opinion about the chair. What I think about the chair doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what I think about the chair. I'm not here to tell you what I think about it. The only reason I'm here in your class today is to do my very best job to describe this chair to you called abstinence until marriage. I'm trying to describe that thing called abstinence until marriage as factually and objectively and clearly as I possibly can so you understand what it is so that you know if you want to do that or not. Does that make sense? So I lay that out to them. And then I say, if you have other speakers coming in, you should be evaluating whether they're telling you their personal opinion or whether they have facts to back it up. It's very important to be able to understand that. And usually the teacher is sitting over here listening to all of this. So these are important things to understand. So that's the difference between objective and subjective. And like I said, I just make that clear with high school students, the difference between those two things. Not so much with middle school, sometimes maybe, but especially high school students, yes. And college students, of course. In fact, I'll tell you one quick thing. I had a really cool opportunity to speak at the University College of Dublin in Ireland, and I was doing a debate out there, and I took my 16-year-old daughter with me at the time. We had a weekend in Ireland. It was wonderful. But it was really kind of cool because I was in this very sort of Harry Potter-ish sort of auditorium in Ireland, and this girl raises her hand, and she says, what's your opinion about... And I said, stop right there. I didn't fly all the way across the Atlantic to give you my opinion. My opinion doesn't matter. You don't even know me. Why would you care what my opinion is? See? I came here not to tell you what I think, but to tell you what I know. Everything I'm sharing is fact-based, not opinion-based. My opinion doesn't matter. Does that make sense? So I use that illustration because I think it's really, really important to always keep those categories clear and try to do that. All right, so objective, subject. Now what I want to do is I want to combine these things, okay? So I want to combine inductive, objective, deductive, objective, inductive, subjective, and deductive, subjective. So this is going to be asking questions that are based in fact. This one is going to be making statements that are backed in fact. This one is going to be asking questions that are based on opinion, making statements based on opinion. Does that make sense? Is that pretty clear? Okay. Now, if you're going to teach a class, which of these four quadrants do you want to hang out in? Where are you going to hang out the most? Someone say. This one here? Deductive, objective? So you want me to stand in front of the class and say a bunch of stuff to the kids? Huh? Well, if you put it that way... So you think this one? Yeah. So, very good. So here's the way I say it. So I say, where would you like to hang out? I want to hang out here. My methodology that's in all my workbooks goes like this. Most of my material is here. Some of my material is here. A little bit of my material is here. And none of my material is here. Does that make sense? Now, the reason I say a little bit of my material here is there, it's okay to use subjective, inductive subjective a little bit. It's a little bit of a relief valve. In other words, once in a while you want them to share their feelings about things. That's okay within, but let's keep it under control. Otherwise the whole thing just gets very touchy-feely. Does that make sense? But once in a while I can throw out, what do you think about that? What do you think about that? And then I will usually immediately follow that up with the facts. Okay? So I'll ask for your opinion. Okay, that's great. That's great that you feel that way. Now let me tell you some facts about that. But I never want to do this one down here. And I want to spend why do I want to spend most of my time up here? It's interactive, engaging. What else does the inductive part do? Makes them think. Who's talking more through that methodology? They are. Why is that good? They listen to each other and they listen to themselves. I find for myself, you know, I'm in that kind of an environment, a learning environment, I learn most from what I figured out and said. If they can argue, now that puts me in the position to be able to be the devil's advocate, actually. So when they're able to answer something, when I ask questions and they're answering, I can push back. And so, for example, I'll be, no, it doesn't have to be until marriage. It could just be until they're in love, right? No, until marriage. Why? Because, you see, I can turn it to where they're arguing. Now, if they're arguing it to me, are we winning? Now we're winning. Because if they're arguing the case for abstinence until marriage to me, who else can they argue it to? To their friends, to themselves. See, they're getting it. So what this does is allows us to really work the material to the place where they really get it, right? Now, what's the challenge in doing this? There's a real challenge and danger and difficulty in this. Because I'm trying to communicate fact through them. That can be tricky, right? What's the risk? Or they don't know the facts. Right? Yeah. So I'm mixing a little bit of this in, but I'm asking them, now here's the trick. Why do I want to do this? If they may get it wrong, if they may not know the right answer, then why do it?